This is now talk 6 in the series that we're doing on Matthew's Gospel, the commentary on Matthew. And we have now come to what's known as the Sermon on the Mount. So I'm going to do a section here on chapters 5 to 7, chapter 5 to chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel. And that whole thing together is called the Sermon on the Mount. And it's called that because of where it's preached. And so I'm going to begin to look at this whole thing. So before we begin to look at Matthew 5 itself, I want to look at the Sermon on the Mount as a whole and just make a few comments about it as a whole, collectively. Because the Sermon on the Mount confused me for many years. I used to struggle with it as I looked at it, in terms of what were we meant to do with it? What were we meant to do about the things Jesus says in it? And questions arose for me. To whom does it apply? When does it apply? Also, what does it imply about the current status and effect of the law of Moses? So these issues I struggled with quite a number of years, really. So let's begin to look at the Sermon on the Mount as a whole and ask ourselves some questions. And first question, what really is it? What is the whole thing about? Why is Jesus giving it? And the answer, I think, simply is it's Jesus' interpretation of the real meaning of the law of Moses and of what righteousness is within the context of the law of Moses. Now, that's significant because you've got to put this talk, this sermon by Jesus, into its proper context. So historically, or whenever you're looking at a speech in the House of Commons, you need to know when was it said. Do you see? So if it will have a major bearing on what is being said, why it's being said. So take something as simple as this. The speeches of Winston Churchill in the early years after the Russian Revolution. He was speaking against the Russians and in favour of what was called the White Russians. He wanted us to actually fight against Russia and overturn the revolution. All right? So let's call that the late teens, early 20s. And then, of course, in the 1930s, he was speaking against the communists, against Russia. But then, June 1941, he suddenly became pro-Russian. Because the Germans attacked Russia, now he was speaking in favour of Russia, and we wanted to send material to Russia to help them. And then, all of a sudden, when the war was over, now he began to speak against Russia again, and he began to speak about the Iron Curtain and so forth. So if you were looking at one of his speeches, can you see how confused you would become unless you knew, well, when was it made, what was the situation, what was the context? Well, here, likewise with the Sermon on the Mount, you could easily get confused about this if you didn't realise the context and the time. So it's being spoken at a time when the law of Moses was still in operation, because that was in operation until Jesus died. So he and the Jewish people, his entire audience, when he was making this speech, were under the law of Moses. Now, we aren't, but they were, and that's important. So they therefore needed to know what the law of Moses meant and how to understand it correctly. That was necessary for them, very necessary for them, far more so than for us. For us, it's of relevance as an instruction to gain understanding, to gain insight, but we're not under it. We don't have the same pressing need to understand it as they did. And so he was giving his interpretation of the real meaning of the law of Moses. And you might say, well, why would someone do that? Well, of course they would do that. That's what everybody was doing. That's what in particular the Pharisees were doing. So they were preaching to the people their interpretation of the law of Moses, but they were getting it wrong. So the Pharisees were interpreting it wrongly. Now, they had created a vast ocean of material called the oral law, O-R-A-L, oral law, spoken law, not written. Later it became written, It became what's known as the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the writing down of the oral law, but at this time it was oral. And the Pharisees were promoting this oral law in contradistinction to the law of Moses. They were speaking of it as being, in their view, the correct understanding of the law of Moses, but of course it wasn't. Jesus says it's not a correct understanding, and I will now give you, says Jesus, a correct understanding of the law of Moses. Now today, we wouldn't necessarily need to stand up today and give a correct understanding of the law of Moses, because we're not under it. But back then, at that time, on that day, they were. He was under it, they were under it. That's why Jesus obeyed the law of Moses 100% on every single day of his life. And that audience was supposed to do that. Of course, none of them did. Not one of them ever obeyed the law of Moses. Neither has anybody ever. But they were supposed to. Okay. So that's what he was doing, giving his interpretation of the real meaning of the law of Moses and what righteousness really is. Because remember how, if you've ever heard my talks on Galatians, and I speak of how the law of Moses is like a thermometer. It tells you what your temperature is. It tells you whether you're ill. It doesn't make you any better. It doesn't make you well. It just shows you that you're ill. So the law of Moses was primarily given, well, for a number of reasons, but one of its reasons was to show you that you are not righteous, that you are sinful. It's a way of showing that you are a sinner. It reveals you like a mirror, like a thermometer. It shows you what you are. And the only person who could look into the mirror of the law of Moses and see perfection was Jesus himself. Everybody else who looks into that mirror sees sin in that mirror. The law of Moses shows you what you are. Alright, well, let's just say a few things. What isn't the Sermon on the Mount? What is it not? Because I want to now address a few things that people think that it is. And if you read commentaries or hear sermons, you'll frequently hear these things. But also, you'll hear them sort of latent. They're just underlying people's philosophy, underlying people's beliefs, without necessarily being said out loud. But here are some of the things that the Sermon on the Mount isn't. Number one, it's not the gospel. So the Sermon on the Mount is not how you can be saved. That is not how you can come to be a Christian, or come to be made righteous, or come to be converted or justified. That is not how you do it. So obeying the Sermon on the Mount is not going to save you. It won't save you even if you obeyed it, but the point is you can't obey it anyway. Even if you could, it wouldn't save you, and you can't anyway. So number two, the Sermon on the Mount is not the constitution of the kingdom, as many think it is. If it was that, then we would have to obey the law of Moses. We'd have to obey the 613 commands that Moses gave, and we'd have to do so not only now in the church age, but we'd have to do so in the millennium to come. And remember, in the millennium, those of us who've been resurrected will be in our immortal resurrection bodies, but there'll be lots of people, millions of people living on the earth in mortal bodies. They are not going to be under the law of Moses in the millennial kingdom. So it's not the constitution of the kingdom. It's not the law that we are now under. Remember, think in terms of the time this was being said. When this was being said, this sermon was being given, it was not the church age. There was no such thing as the church. Nobody even knew that there was a thing called the church, or that there was ever going to be a thing called the church. The church is what the Bible calls a mystery. That means it's not yet revealed. It means it's a thing that the Bible has not yet revealed. On that day, nobody knew what the church was, or that there would ever be one. This is a Jewish audience expecting the kingdom to come. By kingdom, they rightly understood kingdom to mean the reign on earth, in Jerusalem, of the Messiah over the whole earth. From Israel. That is the kingdom. That is what it means Or at any rate, that's one of the meanings of the kingdom. That's what they were expecting, and rightly expecting, to happen. Because that is what was meant to happen. That was plan A. So the Sermon on the Mount is not the constitution of the kingdom. Thirdly, it's not a set of ethics for the church age. So the Sermon on the Mount is not, in the sense, a rule book for how we are to be now in the church age. Now the thing is, you have to be careful how you put this, because what some people do, as I mentioned earlier about thinking that the Sermon on the Mount is the gospel, you'll frequently find this amongst liberals who believe in what you might call a social gospel, or being a good person. Okay, so being a Christian is about being a good person. And that's how you become a Christian, that's how you are a Christian, that's what being a Christian is, being a good person. And you'll hear people speak of, well, I try to live by the Sermon on the Mount, or, you know, I try to live by the golden rule of love my neighbour as myself, and do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. That's how I try to live. Well, that's complete self-delusion. Nobody lives like that. Nobody even obeyed the law of Moses, never mind the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is the law of Moses taken to perfection, beyond perfection. It's taking the law of Moses and making it even harder, as you'll see when we go into chapter 5 in particular. So the Sermon on the Mount is not a set of ethics that we are to live by, in the sense that they were to live by the law of Moses. Now we are to live by the Sermon on the Mount as a new kind of law for us to be under. The Sermon on the Mount is about the law of Moses. It's a commentary series on the law of Moses. That's what it is about. And the law of Moses is over. Now, someone might leap to the other conclusion and say, well, in that case, the Sermon on the Mount has got nothing at all to do with us, and we can completely ignore it. No, that would be to go too far. That would be to misunderstand the situation. What we're to do is look at the Sermon on the Mount, realize correctly what it is, a commentary on the law of Moses, realize that's what it is, and gain guidance from it as to how a Christian should be. But it's not the same as saying this is a law that we're under now in place of the law of Moses. So it does have relevance and application to us today. It still does. But as long as we see it properly in its context. And so when I say it's not a set of ethics for the church age, as I mentioned, nobody knew about the church. The church isn't even mentioned until Matthew chapter 16. And it's mentioned in, it's predicted in parable form in Matthew chapter 13 when you get to the mystery parables, but we're not there yet. We haven't got there yet. We're talking here on a day when these things have not been spoken of. The very age that we are in, because we are by nature egocentric and we think ourselves to be the centre, what we are in, the church age, we assume to be kind of central. Well, the church age is plan B. It was something that came in because Jesus being king was rejected. And because the Jewish people rejected him as Messiah, collectively rejected him, they didn't all reject him, but because the nation collectively rejected him and their leaders rejected him, the train line was rerouted onto the church age. And you have this lengthy pause when we've been gone onto a new train track, and now we're on this train track called the church age, which was a mystery to them. They didn't know it even existed. We know it, but we mustn't impute to these people the knowledge that we have today from being in the church age, as if what was being said then was about the church age. Do you see? It wasn't about that age. It wasn't about our age. It was about what they were in. So the at that time, looking more closely at the context, what the context was, This is towards the beginning, not absolutely at the beginning, but towards the beginning of Jesus' ministry. And they were awaiting the coming kingdom. Many knew it was the time. Not everyone, but many knew that it was the time when the kingdom must be getting close. How did they know? Because of Daniel's prophecies, they knew. As we saw 30 years earlier in the account given of Anna and Simeon in the temple and so forth. They knew the kingdom was close when they knew that Messiah was going to be born. But now we're 30 years later, and if the prophecies of Daniel weren't enough to tell you that the kingdom is very close, there is the fact that John the Baptist has been openly saying so. That's what he was saying in the desert all that time. The kingdom, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and so on. And if that wasn't enough, Jesus himself said it when he began his ministry. So it's as plain as can be that the kingdom is coming, that it's the time for the kingdom to come. So that being the case, the question arises, what kind of righteousness is needed to enter the kingdom? What do we need to enter the kingdom? Who's going to enter the kingdom? And what kind of righteousness is needed to do so? And the key verse on that, we'll come to it in its proper time, but is Matthew 5:20, when Jesus says, "Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, that's a harsh statement, isn't it? That's a tough one. And the point is, it's like the law of Moses. The Sermon on the Mount is meant to convict us and show us how sinful we are. Nobody has ever obeyed the Sermon on the Mount any more than they've ever obeyed the law of Moses. The Sermon on the Mount is harder than the law of Moses, you know, and therefore no one's ever obeyed it. So that was the context. You need to know, how do we get righteousness? What is righteousness? What does righteousness mean? How much righteousness do you need to have to enter the kingdom? And that's what we'll begin to go into, and especially when we look at chapter 5. So Matthew's gospel, looking more broadly at it, it contains five major discourses or sort of teaching sessions. Because Matthew, rather than setting out with the target of being chronological, as Luke does, Matthew's objective is to focus on the teaching that Jesus gave. And there are five main teaching blocks in there. The Sermon on the Mount, which we're now going to look at, is one of those. That's chapters 5 to 7. And then in chapter 10 of Matthew, you get Jesus' missionary instructions to the disciples. And then in chapter 13, you get what's called the mystery parables, or the mystery parables of the kingdom. Now, what are they? They come as a response to the people's rejection of Jesus, which takes place in Matthew 12. So, in a sense, what is happening here with the mystery parables that we're going to look at in Matthew 13, they are showing us the direction that the kingdom will take as a result of the king being rejected. So Jesus has been rejected in Matthew 12. The mystery parables say, where is the whole project now going to go as a result of the postponement of the reign of Jesus and the rejection of the king? And there's going to be this postponement, and there's going to be things happening during that time, during what we know as the church age. What we are in is the church age, and the mystery parables speak of that age that we are in. And then, fourthly, the community instructions to the disciples given in Matthew chapter 18, and we know that famously for the what I call the Matthew 18 procedure for dealing with disputes and so on within the church. And then finally, what we call the Olivet Discourse, a set of prophetic teaching about end times preceding the second coming of Jesus, and that's in Matthew 24-25. So Matthew's gospel is focusing very much on teaching and what Jesus said. Okay, so that sets the scene. Now what we'll do is begin to enter into the actual Sermon on the Mount itself, and it begins in Matthew chapter 5 was something called the Beatitudes. That's what it's often called. And which really is just the blessings. And so let's look at the beginning of this with verse 1. And it says, seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And then verse 2. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying. And then he goes into the various blessed are this, blessed are that. Now let's look at verse 1. You see, it says here, seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. Well, you might say to yourself, what is this Sermon on the Mount? Is it the same thing that we see spoken of in Luke chapter 6? Because you see, you have something that looks very similar in Luke's Gospel. Beginning at verse 17, so it goes from verse 17 through to verse 49 in chapter 6 of Luke. But is it the same thing? It would not seem to be so. Two main reasons. If you look in verse 17 in Luke chapter 6, it says, he went down with them and stood on a level place. Okay? And then it begins to describe who was there. And if you go on through Luke chapter 6, it doesn't correspond exactly to the Sermon on the Mount. And it also contains things that... So it doesn't contain everything in the Sermon on the Mount. It differs also in some ways. And for example, as you get towards verses 24, 25, 26, it gives what's called the woes. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for that is how the fathers treated the false prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Now those are in Luke's Gospel, in Luke 6, but they're not here in Matthew. And so it would seem clear that Jesus gave this sermon, or sermons like it, sermons plural, in various places, in at least two places. On each occasion when he gave this sermon, it was different, not entirely the same. So the sermon given in Luke, you could call it the Sermon on the Plain, or the Sermon on the Level Place, and you could call Matthew 5 the Sermon on the Mount. Not the same sermon. Anyway, what we're focusing on today is the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. But notice it says, and he sat down. Now you remember last week we were looking at Jesus speaking in the synagogue in Nazareth, how he stood up to read from the Bible, and then, but you sit down to teach. And so here he sits down because he's going to start teaching. So Jesus acted exactly like a rabbi. That's what they do. He'd sit down to teach. Now who's the audience here in Matthew 5? It says, when he sat down, his disciples came to him. Now there were crowds, but there were also his disciples. So the question then is, to whom is this being addressed, really? Well, primarily to his disciples, but there's also a crowd nearby. Some of whom will be his disciples, some just listening, finding out, but a wholly Jewish audience. Okay, and then he begins in verse 3. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So what does poor in spirit mean? It's not talking about being financially poor. It's talking about being... having a right evaluation of yourself before God. It's the opposite of pride. It means knowing that you have no righteousness of your own. So you have no pretentious illusions about yourself or your own grandeur, your own magnificence, your own righteousness and worthiness and so forth. A person who's poor in spirit is humble, is unpretentious, honest. They see they're a sinner, they know they're a sinner, they know they don't have righteousness. They know all that. That's as plain as day to them. I mean, in a sense, it's to state the obvious, isn't it? To To say you don't have righteousness is obvious. To say that you're a sinner is obvious. To say that you're not worthy is obvious. All these things are obvious, but they're only obvious to those who are poor in spirit. If we are prideful or proud, if we are arrogant, if we are conceited, if we are haughty, if we're pompous, it's far from obvious. We'll think of ourselves in a good light, and we'll start using pronouns like they and them to describe sinners, rather than I, we, us, me, and so on. But it's to the poor in spirit, blessed or happy, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then verse 4, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. So, what do we mean here by mourn? Well, not primarily bereavement, not primarily meaning that, but grieving, really, in a broader sense. Not so much about the loss of relatives or friends and so forth, but although it could include that, but it really means mourning over the sinfulness of themselves and their nation and what's wrong with their nation. That it should be grieving us. We should be grieving over it. And one passage that springs to mind as that very word mourn is used, if we think in terms of Ezekiel chapter 9, I think it's quite relevant. Possibly even Jesus had it in mind, I don't know. But in Ezekiel chapter 9, a strange chapter, I'll read out part of it from verse 1. It speaks of, it says, then he cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, draw near, you executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And lo, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, every man with his weapon for slaughter in his hand. And with them was a man clothed in linen, with a writing case at his side. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherubim on which it rested to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen, who had the writing case at his side. And the Lord said to him, go through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark upon the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it. And to the others he said in my hearing, pass through the city after him, and smite. Your eyes shall not spare, and you shall show no pity. Slay old men outright, young men and maidens, little children and women, but touch no one upon whom is the mark. Okay? So it goes on. But the point is this. The picture that we're given is of the time of Ezekiel, the sinfulness of Jerusalem, and of certain people sighing and groaning over it. It grieved them. They mourned over it. And the point is that the judgment of God that was going to come upon the city was to be focused only upon those who did not sigh and groan over the sinfulness of the city. But those who sighed and groaned were exempt. They were not part of that judgment. And so the point is this. You could link that to this. The sort of attitude of mind that we are to have in terms of mourning, we're not primarily talking about mourning for lost relatives and so forth. We're talking here about mourning for the condition, the spiritual condition, the sin condition of ourselves, our families, our nation, the church, mourning over what the abominations that are being committed in our midst. You see, how can you look at Britain today, or America, or Europe, or anywhere really that has these things? Look at what's happening in our society, and the abandonment of Christianity, the incredible foolishness of our nation, the sinfulness, the wickedness, abortions being carried out on an industrial scale. And so we in Britain alone have killed more unborn children than Adolf Hitler killed Jews. We've killed 8 million. Hitler killed 6 million Jews. That is considered to be a terrible thing. Of course, it is a terrible thing. But the point is, we here have killed 8 million. Hitler killed 6 million Jews. The Americans have killed approximately 58 million children. And what do you think God thinks about that? And what is the proper attitude of a Christian who lives in this year? Because there has never been a time in history when that has been done. Any abortions carried out in history were done on a one-off basis, here and there, now and then, occasionally, and they were not done with the express sanction or endorsement of the state. Here what we have today, we have abortion being carried out on an industrial scale with the express sanction of the state. Our parliament has voted to approve it and has repeatedly rejected bills to try to repeal it, and the hospitals, the very gynecological wards that deal with childbirth, are also dealing with the systematic slaughtering of children. And the thing is, you think, well, what is the church doing? Would it be fair to say that the church is mourning, sighing, groaning over that? I think it would be a misnomer, really, to use any of those words about the church at the moment. The church as a whole, when it looks at the abortion situation alone, just that, largely, in the main, with exceptional people here and there, but in the main, by and large, the vast majority of the church is completely indifferent to the subject and has nothing to say about it. Nothing at all. The point is, we might look back censoriously at the 1930s and 40s and say, look at that church in Germany, weren't they terrible? They let Hitler rise to power, and they said so little. And then they must have known about the Holocaust, but they said so little. All right? Now, insofar as it's wicked to kill adults and children and teenagers, which it was, how much more wicked is it to kill unborn children? The proposition is that it's nothing at all. Well, actually, in God's eyes, I think it's, if anything, more wicked to kill an unborn child than to kill a man of 25 or 55 or 75. I mean, you're just comparing degrees of wickedness. They're all wicked. But in relative terms, it's more wicked. So that's just one thing that you could zero in on, about which we should be mourning, sighing and groaning. Just that one issue. But then take homosexuality. Take pornography, promiscuity, the collapse of marriage, the collapse of the family, the collapse of our education system, the godlessness that's being taught in schools, the rise of Islam, the promotion of Islam, the defense of Islam by our government against those who are speaking against it. The government, the state, is supporting Islam against those who tell the truth about it. It's defending Islam. It's bringing, at the moment, waves, hordes of Muslims into the country, which is going to be disastrous for us. Islam is taking over, and our country is asleep. So the people who are in charge of us are fast, sound asleep. They have no idea what's going on. And most of the church is fast asleep and has no understanding of the significance of the influx of Muslims into the country now. No understanding at all. And even if they raise the subject, they generally raise it in order to endorse the influx and to say that it's right to bring in all these Muslims. And if they raise the subject of homosexuality, of gender confusion, if they raise it at all, which they don't tend to, they would tend to raise it in order to endorse gender confusion, to endorse gay marriage, homosexuality, and so on. So that's what much of the church is doing. And so what is the right and proper attitude of a Christian today, seeking to apply Matthew 5 verse 4, blessed are those who mourn? Well, there's something to mourn about. There's something to sigh and groan about. And I think, in the same way that God approved of and had mercy upon those who sighed and groaned in Ezekiel 9, is there any reason to suppose that God's view has altered now, so that now he doesn't have mercy upon or approve of those who sigh and groan? He's not changed. He's exactly the same. So God's view now of those who sigh and groan is exactly the same as it was in Ezekiel chapter 9. Our task is to sigh and groan, to mourn, but also to do so productively, not just to sigh and groan on our own, but to sigh and groan a little bit more constructively than that, whereby we actually speak out. I try to speak out, but the majority of the church, I think it's unarguable, I can say this, the majority of the church, and I mean even the real church, I'm not talking about the apostate or apparent church, the real church, the majority of the real church is not speaking out about homosexuality, gay marriage, gender confusion, political correctness, Islam, abortion, promiscuity, pornography, or anything at all. So all those subjects are completely ignored, and you have this complete landslide that's happening of chaos that's pouring out upon us, and the church is talking about something else. It's talking about goodness knows what, but it's not talking about all the things that are happening to us. At any rate, I believe that that is a valid way to look at the meaning of the word mourn, and something that for us is the outworking of that today. And if we take that attitude, and if we are grieving over these things and speaking constructively about them, I don't just mean shouting and yelling at people, but speaking constructively, speaking the truth to our generation, even if we're on our own. Even if you're the only one in the school, the only one in the factory, the only one in the law firm, the only one in the church, still speak the truth to your generation. Verse 5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now what's meek mean? Meek is one of those words that's almost entirely and uniformly misunderstood. People think meek means sissy-ish, soppy, weak, timid, sort of a poncy, sort of wimpy, limp-wristed, sickly, sort of weedy sort of person. Meek means nothing to do with that. A meek person is someone who, whilst having power and strength and authority, is gentle and self-controlled with it. So you could be, I don't know, a member of the Royal Marines, but you're helping an old lady across the road. You know, you could be heavily armed paratroopers, but you are protecting a group of school children. Do you see? You're being meek. You've got all this power, but you are utterly self-controlled in the way that you use it and manifest it. And your attitude whilst having it is one of humility, kindness, gentleness. So you have great strength, but you use it under strict self-control. Now that's meekness. It has nothing to do with being a wimp, which is the way in which the word has been corrupted and misunderstood so badly. So for example, Moses was meek. He was not a wimp. Jesus was meek, and he was not a wimp either. And so that's what we should do. And one very good picture of Jesus' meekness emerges from Philippians. If you look in Philippians chapter 2, I'll read it out, I don't need to look it up, I'll provide a full service. So in Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 to 11, we see a picture here of what Jesus is like. And look what it says. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Therefore God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Now, look at the attitude displayed by Jesus in that passage, in which we see acted out in the Gospels, particularly in the crucifixion account. At all times during the crucifixion account, Jesus had the power, just by speaking, he could have destroyed the entire city of Jerusalem just by saying, "Be destroyed." Do you see? He could have destroyed all the Romans by just looking at them and saying, "Be destroyed." And they would have all been obliterated. He could have got down from the cross. He could have stopped it at any moment. Now, can you consider the strength of will that is required whilst having that power to not use it? Do you see? Now, that's meekness. And that is what is meant. So would you say of a person who does that they're weak, that they're insipid, that they're limp-wristed, that they're a namby-pamby, that they're sort of puny? No, it's the entire opposite. So meekness means having that kind of humility, self-control, gentleness, whilst at the same time having all the strength and authority that you have. We don't have the strength and authority that Jesus had, but we have a measure of strength and authority, and such as it is, it needs to be exercised with that attitude of mind. That's meekness. Now look what happens to those people who have that quality. It says they shall inherit the earth. Now you might say, oh, what beautiful poetry from Jesus. Look at the beautiful poetry that he's coming out with now. No, it's not poetry. He's saying they shall inherit the earth. He means literally that's what they will do. So the people who are meek will inherit the earth. And when the millennial kingdom comes, the meek people will inherit the earth. Meaning, they will be placed in possession of land and estates and property and other possessions. And they will inherit the literal physical earth, or parts thereof. So a meek person will be well provided for in the millennium. So when the judgment seat happens, part of the reward that will be given to people will be property and land and role and status and position and title within the millennial kingdom. Because the millennial kingdom is absolutely real, physical, literal. It's here on this planet, in Jerusalem, in Israel, in the world. In the millennium, there's going to be a country called England, and in it there will be towns like Birmingham and Manchester and Leeds, and all those places will be there in the millennial kingdom, and people will be in charge of them, and the meek are going to inherit very substantially within that allocation of roles, titles, rewards, land, possessions, etc. It's all completely literal. Okay, well, verse 6. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Well, this is linked in a sense to verse 4 about mourning. But also, you're hungering and thirsting for righteousness, not just righteousness by others. That would be great if other people had righteousness. But it's vastly more important for you to have righteousness than for other people to have righteousness. You might, of course, want others to have righteousness. Of course we do. But you're to hunger and thirst for your own righteousness. It needs to really matter to you that you should become a godly person. That needs to matter to you. Now, my own anecdotal experience, not having the ability to gaze into people's minds and know exactly what they think and what their real motives are, to the extent I can gauge anything, I would say that hungering and thirsting for righteousness is not a key feature within today's church on any widespread basis amongst real Christians. And I speak of real Christians. I'm not talking about the apostate church, the unbelievers. Of course the unbelievers aren't hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Of course the apostate churches aren't hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Why on earth would they? It would be a contradiction in terms. They're apostate. I'm talking about the real church, the real Christians, the converted, the justified, the saved. Take that subgroup of our nation. How many of the real Christians are hungering and thirsting for righteousness? And this is where, you see, when we look at the Bible, when we look at anything like this, the thermometer needs to be put in our own mouth. It's no good going around putting thermometers in other people's mouths. The law of Moses thermometer, the Sermon on the Mount thermometer, is to go in your mouth. And you're supposed to put the thermometer in your mouth and measure how much hungering and thirsting for righteousness is there. And then you pull out the thermometer and see what it says. And I challenge you, and I challenge me, to do that. Ask yourself that. How much hungering and thirsting for righteousness do you actually have? Remembering, we're not talking about wishing that other people were more righteous. Of course we wish other people were more righteous. Of course we do. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about wishing that you were. And each of us has a duty not only to be more righteous, but to want to be. And if we don't want to be, we're not going to be. You'll only ever be what you want to be. You'll only ever become what you want to become. You will never become a dentist if you don't want to be a dentist. You'll never become a motor mechanic if you don't want to be. So becoming anything, it's a prerequisite of becoming anything that you want to become it. Even if you're wanting, it is unconscious. You know, you must want it in order to become it. At any rate, anything decent or anything worth having, you must want it first. So the hungering and thirsting is a measure of your wanting. It's a measure of the degree to which you want this. And so I would suggest each of us put the thermometer in our own mouths and say, how much am I hungering and thirsting for righteousness? Because the point is, they shall be satisfied. Well, satisfied in what way? Well, they'll be satisfied by becoming righteous. What are we talking about here? What kind of righteousness are we talking about here? Well, there are two primary types of righteousness that we speak of. The first righteousness is the righteousness that is imputed to us at the moment of conversion, when we believe and repent and our sins are transferred to Jesus and his righteousness is transferred to us. That's imputed righteousness, which we receive on being converted. And that righteousness is greater than the righteousness of John the Baptist, and it's greater than the righteousness of the Pharisees. So that's imputed righteousness. But there's another form of righteousness that we receive, and this is received gradually as we grow in sanctification. So as we become converted and then we spend the next 60 years being sanctified, we gradually become more righteous, more godly, more just in our day-to-day practical experience of life. So the people around us will gradually notice that the way you were in your 20s, you're better in your 30s, better in your 40s, better in your 50s. I want that to be said to me. When I'm 140, I want people saying, I'll tell you what, he's better than he was when he was 120. And I want it to keep increasing all the time, all the time. That's what it should be. And as you hunger and thirst for righteousness, you will get it in that sanctifying sense, as well as in the imputed righteousness that comes at justification. Alright, well, next, verse 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Now, what's mercy? Mercy is not giving people what they deserve. What's grace? Giving people what they don't deserve. And we, from God, we want mercy from him. We want him to not give us what we deserve. We want his grace. We want him to give us what we don't deserve. And we want those two things from him. Very, very obviously we do. But the point is that those things are to be dispensed by us too, to others. So we are to not give people what they deserve and to give people what they don't deserve. And there's a time and a place for doing that. And the reward for doing that, the consequence of doing that, giving mercy to others, is that mercy will be shown to us. And when will it be shown? If we give mercy to others, when will mercy be given to us? Well, two places. Firstly, it will be given to us in this life, now, in the church age, during our life now. You give mercy to Fred Bloggs, God will find a way, even if it's 10 years later, to show mercy to you in some substantive, practical way. You might not see the connection, but God has an accounts book, and he does see the connection. You might not notice the connection, but you show mercy to Fred Bloggs, God will show mercy to you here, now, on this earth. That's not guaranteed, because you're not guaranteed to remain alive. You might die tonight, so therefore God might not have an opportunity to give you that mercy in 10 years' time, because you're going to die tonight. So that's not guaranteed, but what is guaranteed is mercy to be shown to you at the judgment seat. Okay, so you go to the judgment seat. The degree to which you show mercy to others now, in the way you deal with them and judge them, mercy will be shown to you at the judgment seat when Jesus assesses you. And the degree of latitude and leeway and slack that you give to others, the forbearance you show, the second and third chances that you give to people, the patience that you show, the decision not to respond, not to launch a nuclear attack on someone, but to wait, to show patience, the same mercy will be shown to you in the way that you're judged. Now, of course, there's a time for everything, as we're told in Ecclesiastes. There's a time to show mercy. There's a time not to as well. And wisdom consists of knowing what the time is. So there is also a time to fight. There's also a time to not show mercy. What we're speaking of here is a generic statement in general terms. In general terms, we're to show mercy, but there are times when we are not to. Do you see? And we see that even in the instructions given to the people of the people of the Israelites when they went into the land, to show no mercy to the Canaanites. Now, that was an exception to the normal position. But there are times when we're not to show mercy. But what's being spoken of here is the general rule, from which from time to time we are to depart where there is a reason to depart from it, where it is necessary for us to sack someone, it's necessary for us to prosecute someone, it's necessary for us to press for a life sentence, or to press for a 20-year prison term for this man. You're prosecuting him, and your job is to press for a high sentence, and so on. Do you see, there are times when you're to do that, but the general rule that we're speaking of here is the importance of being merciful. Now, verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Now, what is pure in heart? It's that cleanness, sincerity, innocence, pureness of motive in our words and thoughts and deeds, the purity of the way that we relate to others and speak to others and so on. And let me just read out quickly from Titus 1:5. It says, to the pure, all things are pure, but to the corrupt and unbelieving, nothing is pure. Their very minds and consciences are corrupted. And we need to work on that. We need to work upon our minds. And you know how Paul speaks of be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind? How Paul tells us to take every thought captive. Well, one of the ways in which we're to do that is to become pure. It's our task, it's our project, it's one of our projects that we are to change the way we think and speak, what we watch, what we look at, what we read, what we do, who we mix with, where we go, the company we keep, the films we watch, the music we listen to. All of that needs to be looked at carefully. And Paul speaks of this also in Philippians 4 verse 8. And he says, finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honourable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. And so our task is to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. That's one of our projects that Paul has set for us. And we are to seek to become pure in heart. That's one of the objectives that we have. Whether you're under the law of Moses, whether you're in the church age, whether you're in the millennial kingdom, you're to become pure in heart. That's a right and proper objective. Verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. So what is this meaning? Primarily talking about making peace between believers in the church, within the believing community, where it's possible to achieve it, but also making peace wherever. So it's where possible, where it's appropriate to seek to bring people together and bring peace, if we can do it. Of course, it's not always possible. Sometimes we have to fight. It's not always possible to bring peace. But to the degree that we can do it, it's appropriate to do it, if we can do it. But it is not an absolute. It's not always possible to bring peace. It's not always appropriate to bring peace. Sometimes it's appropriate to fight, where that's the right thing to do. Okay, verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And again, it's meant literally. The kingdom is going to be for these people. They're going to receive the kingdom. What does it mean to be persecuted for righteousness' sake? So persecution will come to the remnant, to those who are genuine, to the real Christians. But it needs to come for righteousness' sake. So the persecution that we receive, if it's going to receive this reward, it needs to be received because of righteousness, not because we're rude, obnoxious, divisive, and so on. And there are some who purport to have discernment, but are actually just opinionated and superior. And you will come across this in many churches which speak of discernment. I mean, obviously discernment is a good thing to have. So are lots of things. But many churches today speak of themselves being discernment type churches. They're discerning. But one feature I've noticed amongst such churches is that there's a significant proportion of people who are very cross, angry, rude, opinionated, and even obnoxious in the way they speak. But it's not just in those churches, it's across the board within the church. There's a lot of people in churches who are very rude and obnoxious in the way they speak to others. And you'll see this, one place where you'll see it is in the debate that exists, that takes place between Calvinists and non-Calvinists. If ever you get engaged in any of that on Facebook or Twitter or anywhere else, you'll see that the manner in which the debate is conducted is frequently very carnal, rude, angry, aggressive. And only the other day I was making a comment on Facebook to this fellow who was a Calvinist, and I think I said a polite thing to him, but he wrote back saying, "I couldn't care less what your opinion is." And then he went on to say some other things that were less than flattering about me. And I thought, and I wrote back to him and said, "Well, even assuming that you're right about Calvinism, I don't think Calvinism is correct, but if you were right, why would you want to explain it to me in such a rude way? Why would you want to share the truth of Calvinism, if it is true, in such a rude way?" And I said to him, "Are you aware that in addition to any alleged truth that might exist in relation to Calvinism, you know, in relation to doctrines like election or predestination and so on, it's also true that we're ambassadors for Christ, isn't it? That's true. It's true that we're supposed to love people. We're not supposed to be like a clashing gong or cymbal. These things are true as well. And we're to reach out to people, and people are not won by rudeness. Do you see?" Anyway, I said this to him. Hopefully I said it in a courteous way. But he just wrote back and was pretty rude again. And what I said to him clearly didn't resonate with him. But the thing is, the way we speak matters, and we're to win people with kindness. And if you're appointed as an ambassador, imagine that the Queen appoints you to be her ambassador to Belgium. The Queen doesn't want you going to Belgium and insulting Belgians and being rude to them, and telling them that they're not very good and they're stupid and you don't care what their opinions are and so on. As an ambassador of Christ, we're to reach out to people. And so I say that because some of the persecution that can be experienced can sometimes arise out of our own rudeness, insensitivity, opinionated boorishness and insensitivity to other people's feelings. So merely being right about things doesn't give you the right to tell everybody else that they're an idiot. It's all the more reason for you to be courteous, because they will frequently decide whether to adopt the true doctrine based on whether you're polite. That ought not to be so, but it is so. All the more reason, therefore, to be polite. Nevertheless, if we are persecuted for righteousness' sake, not for any other reason, then such people will receive the kingdom of heaven. Let me just dash to the end of the Beatitudes. Verse 11 says, "Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account." So, being reviled and having all sorts of evil said about you, simply by itself alone, is not a virtue on your part. So if men are reviling you and saying terrible things about you, that alone isn't what gains you a reward. What gains you a reward is if those things are being said falsely on Jesus' account. So if men are falsely saying things about you because of Jesus, because you're faithful to him, because you're teaching the truth about him, that will obtain for you the blessing that's spoken of here. But you will not receive a blessing, as per verse Matthew 5:11, if you're being reviled because of your bad behavior, carnality, worldliness, sinfulness, haughtiness, being Nicolaitan, being authoritarian, being a controller, being manipulative, and all the other kinds of things that are true of many, many, many people in churches. So that sort of criticism being levelled at you will not bring you a reward, but only if it's said falsely on Jesus' account because of your faithfulness to him. And then verse 12, "Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so men persecuted the prophets who were before you." And again, this is meant literally. The reward spoken of is literal. The precise nature of it, the precise what it will be, is hard to say. But one thing we can be sure of, it's going to be good, and it's going to be literal, and it's going to be real. And we need to take it seriously. And the rewards will be given out at the judgment seat, but they'll be subsequently retained and experienced and enjoyed and used in the millennial kingdom and thereafter in the eternal state. And we need to take this concept of reward very seriously. So we just looked at the first 12 verses there of Matthew 5, and can you see, notwithstanding that these things are being said during the age of the law of Moses, can you see that they still have many applications for us? Notwithstanding that the law of Moses is over now, they're still of relevance to us, because these are still applicable to us, because they're of general application. Alright, well, I'm going to stop at that point. We'll carry on next time with the salt and light section of Matthew 5.